Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have with me a very, very interesting guest. Join me in welcoming Pratham Mittal, who's the co-founder of Masters Union. Thank you so much, Pratham, for joining me. Very delighted to be hosting you.
Glad to be here.
Great. I think I'm so excited primarily because, as I was telling you, it's very difficult to have people who can speak passionately and curiously about a variety of things. And I think you're one of those well-read, well-educated, well-experienced founders who can mostly do that. However, for the benefit of the conversation, I'd love to discuss more specific things and what you're doing with transforming higher education, as I like to think about it, right? Because I think you have this insane thesis about what's broken. Mm-hmm. You also have insane action to back it and now be like, this is the hypothesis with what you started and this is what's going to. But I want to start off at an abstract note,
sure.
Right? For the benefit of the audience, I think two things that for me stand out about your experiences are one, that you've put yourself in very different situations, be it, you know, having born in Jalandhar, if I'm not wrong, then going to the Dune School, then studying in the US at UPenn, doing your undergrad, then starting a company, then coming to India, right? All very diverse experiences. Yep. And almost putting your foot down and saying that if somebody else can, why can't I?
Yeah.
And you've proven that multifold now. So if you can maybe talk about these two specific things, what they mean for you, and maybe if you can start there, that'll be awesome.
So the first is diversity of experience.
Yes.
And second is if somebody else can, why can't I? Right? All right. So let's start with the diversity of experience.
Yeah.
So when I was in college in the US, actually when I was in school in India, in Dehradun, at the Dune School, you know, you could act in a play in the afternoon. In the evening, you could be playing a soccer game. Yeah. At night, you could be swimming in a competition. Right, and the next morning, you would be doing a PT, you know, with one of the PT leaders. So, interestingly, when I graduated Dune School, I realized that I hadn't made use of all the opportunities available to me. So, even though I could have done all these four things, I in fact never acted in a play. I in fact never learned how to play soccer. I never went to PT and, you know, built any muscle. Right.
Yeah.
So when I graduated Dune School, I graduated with a lot of regret. I saw my friends who had made use of all the opportunities that they had, and I hadn't. Right. So when I went to college in the US, I went with this sort of thought that mere ko college ko nichodna hai. Like I want to get the last little thing that the college can give me and take everything out of it. Like I want to suck life out of college. Right. And so right from my first semester in college, I started acting in plays. I started, you know, becoming part of random clubs. Like I was even part of the gender studies club.
Wow.
Right. I was part of, I used to go to the LGBTQ center and hang out. Right. I used to, I tried to learn a musical instrument. I tried to learn tabla. Right.
Wow.
All the things that I'd missed in school, I did it in college. Right. And when I graduated college, I honestly had no regrets. Right? I was like, there's nothing that I did not do. There was not a single person I did not know the name of. There's not a single, you know, like dinner clubs, as we used to call it, that I wasn't part of, right?
Yeah.
I even joined a fraternity. And I feel like, you know, a lot of friends would tell me, yeah, you're not going deep into anything. You're trying to cover lots of things, but not going deep into anything. And I'm like, that's all right.
Yeah.
That's okay. Like, I'm in the US for 4 years. At that time, that was a plan. you know, let me just do everything. And so I think it's all of this came from this experience of having missed out in school, right? And then it became a habit over time. Then it became a habit, right? I always wanted to be part of the party or whatever, FOMO.
Yeah.
Right? And so when I started up, I wanted to be part of, you know, I wanted to start up in first in tech, right? And then like, you know, blockchain came. I wanted to do something in blockchain. I was easily distracted. And that wasn't a good thing, right? In the beginning, I would try to do this also, this also, this also. And I realized that, you know, if you really want to excel, then you have to pick one thing and go really deep. So I think first phase of my life, I did everything. And then now I've become a little bit more measured in how I choose what to do.
Fair enough. You also went ahead and won this Princeton hackathon, right? Which kind of was a game changer because you almost mentioned on the record that you didn't expect to win.
Yeah.
Was that a turning point in your life? Did that kind of like define the fact that you can go ahead and do anything with the smartest kids out there?
Absolutely. So I was at Penn and Princeton is 2 hours away.
Right.
Okay. Penn is in Philadelphia, Princeton is in Jersey. And generally, Princeton is thought of as one of the top schools in the world. And Penn is like the second or third, right? Like it's always been that way that, and I know Penn kids are almost insecure about this a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I went to Princeton because Princeton was hosting a startup weekend. And that weekend, I was free. Right? And I was like, all right, let's do this Startup Weekend. Yes. And I, in fact, went in not knowing what Startup Weekend is. I actually went because one of my friends wanted to go.
Okay.
Right. And so I just went. Mm-hmm. And there you have to build your own team. You have to pitch your idea to a bunch of people and try to sort of create a team around you.
Yeah.
And then you sort of work on that idea. Yeah. And then you pitch, right? And I said, all right, let me build a team. Nothing to lose, kind of a thing. So I built a team. Luckily, like 5-6 people joined that idea that I was interested in. And then we hacked up throughout the weekend. And in fact, our product didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It did not work at all. However, we created some HTML pages that sort of depicted the product working. Wow. And we just attached those HTML pages together.
So you literally hacked in.
So we literally hacked it, right? We tried to code it a little bit, but nahi ho raha tha. That wasn't right. happening. So we thought it might as well just fake it till you make it sort of a thing. So we created that and we presented it
mm-hmm.
to the judges. And for a pen kid to win in Princeton was like a big deal. It was like a big deal. Princeton was a college that rejected me.
All right.
When I was applying to colleges in the US.
Yeah.
So now it's like redemption time. So that gave me so much confidence that hey, listen, like, you know, if you just like throw in your hat, there is a good chance you'll actually win also.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you throw in your hat 10 times, mm-hmm. even if you don't have merit, even if you don't have skill, even if you don't have, you know, the right skill sets, etc., you can still win just by chance.
Yeah. No, that's true testament of it. The other interesting part about this, and you've spoken about this in the past, that, you know, higher education in the US helps you design a life which is, I mean, structured to interact with different people, which does not happen as easily maybe in India, right? And so much of what you just mentioned is a factor of the experiences you had because there were such diverse people there. Mm. What, according to you, can one do to design a life centered around different experiences?
Yeah.
And how important is it, right? Because, I mean, we tend to miss out most things because we're following a manual playbook that somebody else has designed for us.
Mm.
And we don't have control. But when you're in the US, that manual playbook actually has diversity in it. What do you think about that?
So first of all, I don't think that's only US.
Okay.
You could achieve that same thing in India as well.
Yes.
It's more about the diversity of experience. It doesn't matter whether it's in the US or India.
Fair.
So that's number one. I think I went to a good college in the US, right? I'm sure that if you go to an average college in the US, your experience would be just like an average college in India.
Fair.
Right. So that's at the outset, right? I think what you're alluding to is around meeting diverse set of people, being engaged in diverse set of activities, and just sort of learning diverse set of skills, maybe taking diverse set of classes, right? What all of these things do is that it helps you really understand how other people think, right?
Mm-hmm.
It helps you empathize with the larger world. I used to be in this class, very interesting story. I used to be in this class called the African politics class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had no idea about Africa before that. And I was in this African studies class where one of our professors was the ex-education minister of Ghana. Okay.
Wow.
And he would, you know, give us stories about, like, you know, how things used to happen in Ghana, all of that stuff, right? And he was giving this example of Burundi and Rwanda, which actually used to be one country before. And it was divided. And the way it was divided was that there was a river, and they said that everything on the west bank would be Burundi, and everything on the right bank would be Rwanda. However, over after 3-4 years,
mm-hmm.
the river actually changed its course.
Ooh.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
And then there was this huge war, right? What is what?
Yeah.
So I learned about this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I took classes, as I told you, in gender studies, right? Which sensitized me to like those topics. Now, every time I meet a person from Africa or from, you know, Rwanda, I just know where they're coming from. I just know what their life was all about. I took classes, let's say, in mechanical engineering. So I meet a mechanical engineer. I know what his life might look like, right? So what this diversity of experience does is that it makes you relatable to a lot many more people.
Yeah. And he says empathy?
Empathy, yeah. Empathy. And then once you have empathy, then you can have better relationships. Now, you're from Calcutta.
Yeah.
Right? Because of Dune School, I had 2 or 3 friends, very close friends of mine, who are from Calcutta.
Yeah.
Right? And so they told me their stories of Calcutta.
Yeah.
They told me their stories of those bazaars and everything, right? And so every time, you know, we meet, like there's a certain amount of familiarity that I have with you, even though we've only just met.
Yeah. Right?
And that to me is empathy. That to me just makes deeper relationships. So the diversity of experiences brings you closer to people.
Yeah.
Does that chain of thought make sense?
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it goes, it's not often mentioned how important diversity can be. As they say, we're a factor of the people we surround ourselves, whatnot, right? It's said a lot, but I don't think we design for it very consciously. We just rely on assumptions and we want to be in our comfort zone almost, right? Yeah. And that's where familiarity to already experienced folks kind of like makes sense. We want to hang around with our same friends. But people who can, and I think founders really go out of their way to surround themselves with all kinds of people. And that's the kind of energy I radiate best with. But I don't think anyone designs for it, actually.
I think for me also, it was serendipity. It was by chance that these things happened, right? It's very hard. And for colleges to design for this, it's incredibly hard.
All the more challenging.
Yeah, I mean, but I'll be happy if colleges in India or even in the US just teach the curriculum properly.
No, designing for diversity. L1.
Yeah, that's L1. Designing for diversity of experience is hard. However, there are certain... One thing about colleges in the West is that they have a lot of international students.
Yeah.
Right? And so that by default brings in diversity of experience. Because your roommate might be from Ghana. Your assignment mate might be from Rwanda. You know, it could be from anywhere.
Yeah.
And so because of that, you automatically have a diversity of experience.
Exactly.
In India, most colleges, barring the IITs perhaps or the IIMs, are localized.
Correct.
Right, are localized. So you only meet people from your own area.
Similar backgrounds. Exactly. It always remains in your comfort zone. But yeah, I think that point is very important to iterate. This has been interesting, but let's go to another side of you now, which is the founder side. Yeah. And before going to the master's union aspect, you've built a company in the past, which is Outgrow.
Yeah.
And that was a very interesting, non-funded, two-founder person team, right? Almost bootstrapped. Cash-rich business, you had revenue, which is stable, and you build that over a period of time. You also come from a family of, you know, entrepreneurs. Correct. You've seen business. Yeah. And of course, Mittal that's established. Yes, it's in your name. It's in your blood. Talk to us about how do you look at entrepreneurship? What was that first stint like for you? And how did that define your sort of founder persona?
So, you know, my father started his career working in a sweet shop, our family sweet shop.
Yeah.
And the sweet shop is called Lovely Sweets.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would go there. And he would sit behind the counter and he would actually cut bills, right? Cutting bills. And I used to love it, right? Because he would receive money and he would write the bill and then he would, you know.
Yeah.
So that to me was my first stint in entrepreneurship, right? And so on Sundays, I was allowed to sit behind the counter and do that same thing, right? And so, you know, like how you count cash, like I'm really good at that. Like I can do that very quickly. So that experience was, I think, my first stint with entrepreneurship, because I remember like some customers would come and, you know, try to haggle, or some customers would come and try to sort of like say, nahi, aapki ye mithai kharab nikli.
Yeah.
And then you have to convince them otherwise, right? And so as I was maybe like 5, 6, 7 years old when I started doing that. Thereafter, my dad started a different business in automobiles where he was selling cars. He got a dealership of Bajaj and Maruti, right? And then I would go there and I would see how the salespeople would be selling the cars, and how on weekends, on Saturdays, dad would take a sales meeting where he would call all the salespeople, and then salesperson by salesperson, you know, everyone would talk about what their target was and how much they achieved. And then the rest of the team would clap or whatever, right? And there'd be that sales appreciation event.
Yeah.
That to me, I think, was my second stint with entrepreneurship, right? And I remember one time I got to read out the, you know, the sales targets and everything. So I think in family business settings, you get exposed to entrepreneurship very early on. Yeah. So for me, there was never any other career path. Like I didn't sit for placements. I didn't.
Yeah.
So there's a very interesting story actually. So I actually interned at a different company. It was a small studio, like a venture studio in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Trigger Media. And they used to incubate media companies. Daily Candy, etc. were some of the companies they had incubated at that time. And I started working there. And I'm not kidding. Within two weeks, I basically got fired.
Oh, wow.
Because what I would do is in the lunchtime, I would just go close by. There was this place called General Assembly, right? And they used to host these meetups, entrepreneurship meetups, and like some speaker would be coming all the time. And I would go there for like lunch so that I could listen to somebody. But I would end up staying a little bit over, right?
Yeah.
So I always got late coming back from lunch. And then the founder called me and he's like, dude, listen, this is not going to work. And he basically like threatened to fire me. He basically fired me. And then I said, no, please, like my visa, otherwise I can't stay in the US, whatever. Yeah, so I think it's just like, and even today, right, when we go back home, I feel like it's not that you switch off work and you switch on home.
Yeah.
For us, work and home is like very intertwined. We go back home, we sit on the dinner table and we talk about work.
Yeah.
Right.
And very different conversations, not the funding, not the growth.
No, it's all dhanda. It's all dhanda conversations. And then in the morning you wake up, and the first thing you see is your phone, and then like you start applying to emails, and then you're... It's just, I think, a way of life. It's like you have religion.
Mm-hmm.
I think like in our community, business is the religion.
Absolutely. Oh, that's lovely. Coming to the other side now with Masters Union, before we get into what you're doing, you have this very interesting thesis about how education is broken, right?
Yeah.
And there's this, of course, famous reel, and you've spoken about this in the past, that the way of education delivery, the modes have changed. There's a lot of tech in it, but the way has not fundamentally changed, right? And a lot of that is something that you're trying to champion. Two questions there. One is, I want to understand, if this is a problem that's lying in plain sight, then why is something not being done proactively on a larger scale about it, right? Why are you the one talking about it and not everybody else, right? That's one. Second is...
It's a very controversial question.
But I'd love to know your thoughts, because it almost feels like there needs to be more of a conversation around it, right? But nobody's talking about it. Everybody's just okay with status quo. Yeah. Nobody's objecting to it. Everybody's like, let's be as it is. And the second is, with this depth of a thesis, right, how do you think this eventually becomes a ripple effect?
Yeah.
So it's an extension of the first question. But what do you think about that?
Okay. It's a very good question, Very deep. So let's start with this. Education has not changed in 2,000 years, right? Yeah. I've said this before thousands of times. And the reason it has not changed in 2,000 years is because in most of the world, education does not invite, the education industry does not invite entrepreneurs.
Hmm.
Okay. The reason for that is education industry in most countries is not for profit.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
So if I am an innovative entrepreneur, why would I want to build an organization that's not for profit? There would be some people.
Right.
There would be some people who are motivated to build a not for profit. You have Salman Khan, the founder of Khan Academy.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, because the industry is not for profit,
mm-hmm.
it does not invite, it is not very lucrative to high achieving, ambitious entrepreneurs.
Right. Okay,
that's
fair.
The basic reason, right? Number one. Number two, the people who run educational institutions are people who are products of the same educational institutions. So an IIT professor today was an IIT student some time back.
Right.
And he was taught by an IIT professor who was an IIT student some time back.
Yeah.
So there is that vicious circle going on, which does not invite outside perspective to come in. And if you do not bring in outside perspective, if you do not bring in original out of the box people or thoughts or perspectives, the business will just not innovate. My father says something very interesting.
Yeah.
A professor came to him and said, you know, Mr. Mittal, I have 25 years of experience teaching. My father says, no, you have 1 year of experience 25 times over.
Wow, that's deep.
Right? And that explains the problem with education.
Yeah.
You do not have 25 years of experience. You have 1 year of experience repeated 25 times.
Yeah.
Right? And so these are some of the reasons because of which education has not innovated. Because it's not for profit. Because the people running it are people of the same, the product of the same system. The other thing, and this is very, very sad, is that people who choose to teach... for whatever reason, choose this career path because it's seemingly safe and secure.
Yeah. It's not because of the passion of it. It's almost like a...
Yeah, some people are driven by the passion of it.
Yeah, but a low proportion.
I think that would be 10%.
Yeah.
I think 90% of people who end up teaching are teaching for the wrong reasons.
Mm.
Right? They're not teaching for the love of teaching. They're teaching because it's a safe job.
Yeah.
Which it is.
Yeah.
Which it is, right? And that goes back to it being a not-for-profit, right?
Yeah.
All of those things. So have you ever heard of a university or college laying off staff? It just doesn't happen, right?
Right.
So I think to break this vicious circle of there being no innovation in education. We are still teaching the same way Aristotle or Plato taught 2000 years ago. I think we need to bring in outside perspective. We need to bring in people who are not from the education industry to come into the education industry.
Yeah.
And that's where sort of Masters Union's idea came about, right? Mm-hmm. Can we bring in practitioners from the industry to come in and teach? Then they will teach differently because they are used to innovation. If you bring in founders to come into the campus, they'll obviously challenge the status quo of education as well, right? I also come from a SaaS background, right? A hardcore software background. And so I bring all of those learnings and all of those sort of breaking the status quo of all energy into education.
Absolutely.
That has just not happened. And so the reason we are able to do this is because we are a for-profit company.
Yeah.
Right? And so the only disadvantage I have is that I cannot give a degree.
Hmm.
Right. So up until now, people have not come into education for profit because they could not give degrees. But guess what? Today, degrees are becoming less relevant.
Yeah.
Right. So I can start an educational institution, master's or even undergrad.
Yeah.
Even if there's no degree, because, hey, you know what? My students are getting placed. The industry is inviting them with open arms. So if the industry is accrediting me, I don't care if the UGC, AICT, all of these organizations do not accredit me.
Yeah.
And so the ripple effect that you spoke about gets created that if I do well, if Masters Union does well, both yeah. financially and on B school rankings, then other B schools would be like, hey, listen, we can also
yeah.
do this.
Yeah. You need that one champion for the others to follow.
Right.
And this becomes an example poster.
This becomes an example. And financially, if it does well, then it invites other entrepreneurs to come in and try this.
Yeah.
And on the rankings, it does well. It invites other B schools, existing ones that are too caught up in the status quo.
To rethink their process, rethink their, yeah. if not anything else.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's brilliant. I think that's a lot of food for thought. And I think a lot of people need to proactively just put their mind into questioning the basics in education. Because I think, again, the problem of we just think of it as a process that's there for the adage and we don't really challenge it. But I think what you're doing is brilliant. And coming to that, right, I think before we talk further about Masters Union, if you can just give us a precursor for all that's happening right now, because I've had the pleasure of being to campus and I've really enjoyed all my interactions, be it with you, the team, the students yeah. in some shape or form, the faculty. The
students love you.
Yeah. And I'm so glad. But I think it's a very, very interesting concept in the sense that on paper, we all know that it exists, mm-hmm. but in practicality, it's not really happened, especially mm-hmm. not that I know of. But what you're trying to do is very, very interesting. So maybe talk to us just about the what is happening part of it, and then we'll go into the depths of it.
Specifically about Masters Union?
Yes.
Okay. So it's very simple, yeah. And it's just two things, actually. First is that we are trying to bring in practitioners to come and teach, right? Mm-hmm. That was the thesis. And what is happening is that because we are in Gurgaon, because most of the companies are set up here, in fact, in the same building that we are sitting in right now, a lot of these practitioners can just walk over and teach. So it's very easy for them to teach.
Yeah.
Right. So that's happening today. And it's happening beautifully. The second thing is that we challenged ourselves to think about a classroom beyond slides, exams, lectures, whiteboards, all of that. Yeah. Right. So in our classrooms, we have none of that. Right. Or we try to reduce that as much as possible. Yeah. There are certain courses you have to teach in a fundamental way, but mostly we push our teachers, our practitioners to come and teach in a hands-on way. Right? Mm. And what does hands-on mean? I can give a few examples. To learn accounting, either you can sit and sort of, you know, draw those lines and, you know, create that credit, debit balance, right? Right. But the problem with that is that you don't see how that would be helpful to you later in life.
Correct.
That's why most students basically like doze off in an accounting class. They're like, main kyun kar raha hu credit debit? Kya fayda hona iska mereko? What we try to do is we say, hey, listen, here's a small shopkeeper who runs a kirana ki dukaan, right? Why don't you go there and audit his books, right? And now suddenly you've changed the game completely.
Yeah.
Right? Now the student wants to help the kirana ki dukaan. And you change the game even further by saying whoever gets the best review from the owner, from the business, they get the best grade.
Right.
You've changed the game. And I think that makes teaching very hands-on. That makes learning very hands-on. You know, you've seen that pyramid, right? That when you read something, you register it 10%. If you hear something, you register it 20%. If you see something, you register it 40%. That's where our classes stop today. hearing, seeing, reading, right? Yeah. So that means you've only achieved 40%.
Yeah.
Now to achieve that, the next 60%, you have to experience it. Yes. You have to live it.
You have to do it.
And so that's why people say, you know, I learned most of my skills on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're actually applying what you're learning in the job. And so that's what we're doing at Masters Union, essentially, right? Can we create this on-the-job experience day-to-day in the classroom?
Yes, and no, that's brilliant. I can testify for it. That begs the question, though, that, you know, when you're trying to do something which is radically different, because when you hear of it, if I had to compare this to a general B-school setting, as opposed to classes with renowned professors and alums, you're now building an experience where you have, you know, a lot of hands-on experience, no classes, and with people who may not have traditional teaching as an experience, right? So you're trying to do this. I understand why now it's making sense. Talk to us about that first cohort, right? When you were trying to do this, like what was the... I understand why you had belief, but how did you instill belief in the people around you? How do you attract the first set of... First cohort, like why did that those 60 people join?
See, if you're trying to innovate, right?
Yeah.
You can't innovate the entire thing.
Fair.
There has to be certain level of familiarity.
Hmm.
Otherwise, people will not steps. Buy. Yeah. Otherwise, people will not buy into your idea. Yeah. If you say, hey, listen, you know, stop drinking Coke today and start drinking...
Sparkling water.
Sparkling water. Today only. Abhi.
Yeah.
People will not do it.
Hmm.
You will say, you know what? Drink Coke 2 days a week and then reduce it. Dhire dhire.
Yeah.
Right? You have to sort of let it burn on the simmer. Dhire dhire. So in our first year, we did not say any of these things.
Okay. Okay.
In the first year, we did not say we're going to change education. In the first year, we did not say we're going to have like no exams, no lectures, no none of this. We did not say that you're only going to have practitioners come and teach. We did not say any of that. We said, hey, listen, it's going to be a PGP. Even today, it's a PGP, which is something that people are familiar with.
Yes.
You're going to have a campus, which is something people are familiar with. You're going to have classrooms because people expect to see that in a campus.
Yeah.
However, 50% of all courses would be co-taught by practitioners.
Hmm.
Right? If I had said year one, you know, no classrooms, no nothing, people would be like, yeah, pagal
ho gaya. I love that. I think that's a very interesting way to look at it because if you're doing something radically different, you can't just shock the consumer.
You can't shock.
Yeah.
You will get so much mistrust.
Correct. You have to lay the pieces. That's a very good way to think about it.
So in the first year, maybe the innovation was only 15%, 20%.
Hmm.
Then 30%. Then 40%. Today also, I'm only at 40%, 50%.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to cover.
How do you stay patient?
It's strategy, right?
Hmm.
I think it's a strategy. I read this in some article. I'm forgetting what article this was. That, you know, there has to be certain amount of familiarity in every innovation.
Hmm.
Otherwise, people will get too scared.
Yeah.
Right. So in the very beginning, we said, hey, listen, you know, we are going to lay out our carpet dhire dhire. Otherwise, it will get too much for people to absorb. And especially education is something that you're only going to purchase once or maybe twice in your life. It is that item that you perhaps spend the most in your life for, other than buying a home or a car. Yeah. Sometimes more expensive than a car. We are more expensive than any car.
Yeah.
Right. So people really think about where they go to school, where they go to college, right?
Yeah.
Like how many times have you discussed this with your parents have discussed with their friends, bachche ko kahan bhejna hai, ye wo.
Correct.
You don't think about purchasing anything else this much.
Absolutely.
So that's why we have to be very sensitive about how we are pitching. So in our first year, it was just about, hey, some practitioners will come and teach. Yeah. In year two, it became, you know what? All classes practitioners will come and teach.
Yeah.
Okay, people are like, okay. By that time, our placement report was out, so there was some trust.
Yeah.
And now the third year, we are coming and saying, hey, listen, you know what? Throw away the classroom.
Mm.
We're going to do everything hands-on.
Yeah.
Right. And now people are like, okay, interesting. Okay, what's next? What's next?
Yeah.
Right. And so in the very first year, I did not start undergrad.
Yeah.
We started with masters because we know that our early adopter audience would be a master's audience because undergrad audience is still a little bit more sensitive to all of these things.
Yeah.
Right. Parents will not be able to venture.
It's a larger commitment also. Four-year
commitment.
Yeah.
Parents make the decisions rather than the students. And parents are usually not early adopters because they're very protective of their kids.
Yeah.
So we're only starting undergrad in our fourth year.
Yeah.
Right. And now people have warmed up to us. And now I can say, hey, listen, you know what? Undergrad be here.
Yeah. Now we're going to talk more about that. But I love this point around patience as a strategy. Because I feel so many people talk about the fact that it's eventually founders who come in their own way when they're trying to scale.
Mm.
And if you're patient, if you're not patient, that can be a deterrent. But I think what you mentioned about just being very strategic about this innovation cycle is very cool. The other design challenge...
Can I challenge you on that a little bit?
Tell me.
Sorry. So, just a thought experiment, right?
Please.
I feel like founders come in their own way when it's a venture-funded company.
Yeah, fair enough.
Right. Like, I've seen companies being built in the venture-funded way.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked very closely with some of the founders.
Yeah.
And I've also seen companies built in the traditional way, bootstrap way, and I've built one myself. And I feel like, you know, when you're building sustainably, when you're building for profit, when you're building bootstrapped, then every action that you take, every expense, you think about it 5 times, 6 times.
Because you don't have luxury.
You don't have the luxury. You can't go wrong because you don't have money to go wrong.
Fair.
But when you are venture funded, I'm not talking about everybody here. I'm talking about that 5, 10, 20% of founders who do come in their own way.
Yeah.
I think in their pursuit to hyperscale, they come in their own way.
Yeah.
Or when they're hyperscaling, their egos come in their own way. Right? So, and you know what percentage of companies are venture funded? Not even 1%.
Yeah.
Right? So I think in our media, we talk more about
venture funded companies.
So we try to generalize this founders coming in their own way kind of thing. But I think in a in like an old economy business,
yeah,
I don't think that happens actually. I think founders are very measured. I think founders are very responsible.
I agree. I think the more important point I was trying to make is the fact that when you're scaling, the 5%, 10% companies that are unable to scale effectively, it's the, you know, 1% gap of not getting out of your own way, hiring the best people, like things like I think those are different. That's but I completely agree. I mean, being venture-backed just misaligns objectives, and then you have to do things that you may not want to do, and which is what you have to be comfortable with as a venture-funded founder. And when you're not, I think this happens. Correct. So,
and from the investor's perspective, it's totally fine if a few founders come in their way because they're hyperscaling and they're investing for hyperscale.
Yeah.
So, 10 mein se 9 band ho jaye, koi tension nahi hai. Correct. That was part of the business plan.
Yeah, no, I think that's another debate because I think investor-founder... incentives are very misaligned.
Oh, yeah.
Investors like gain even if 9 companies fail and 1 succeeds. Okay. But I think when the 9 companies fail, those 9 company employees, the founders, their families, there's such a ripple effect. I think that's for another time.
Yeah.
But the other important challenge, in my opinion, and I've been thinking about this since I came, and I don't think I've had a chance to address it out loud, is that education by definition has these defined outcomes by which you are evaluated. In your case, it is placements, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why the emphasis on it is well. However, I feel that it's so difficult to guarantee or rather, you know, assure a certain sense of placement style that it moves you in different ways because you have to address placements and eventually have that as an outcome. Since that's your North Star and not experience, can you tend to not follow what's in your heart and do things because the eventual goal is placements? I mean, just as a design problem, how do you address it?
Great question. So I think the way we approach placements is very different here at Masters Union, right? So generally, if you look at a business school, and this is true for, you know, Wharton, Harvard, Stanford, everybody, is that I know that I want to get into Bain. I don't want to get into Microsoft. I know I want to get into Google. So all my classes, all my projects, everything would be geared towards that.
Exactly.
Right? Because placements start very early in the process.
Yeah.
You've just started and you start thinking about, you know, where I'm going to get placed. Summer internships will start within 6 months.
Correct.
All of that.
Yeah.
So here, what we are trying to push our kids into doing, so our placement strategy is that we force everybody, as you know, to build a company in each term.
Yeah.
To have that 0-1 journey in each term. So in term one, students build e-commerce dropshipping websites. In term two, students build a YouTube page and they try to monetize it. In term three, they build layer 2 blockchain protocols. In term 4, Cloud Kitchen. Term 5, whatever, XYZ. Now, as they have these experiences of building companies, they become very good at that 0-1 journey. They become experts, you know, in teams of 5, they usually do these companies and one would become an expert in managing finances. One would become an expert in managing digital marketing. One would become an expert in leadership, bringing everyone together. And as you build these skills, placements automatically solve for themselves, right? So let me give you some data examples, right? So last year, one of our students, he started this company called Zood for Food as part of one of his projects.
Okay.
Which was basically helping people when they're trying to sort of order on Zomato. It takes them a lot of time to figure out what to order on Zomato.
Yeah.
So it was an AI that would recommend to you what to order.
Brilliant.
Right. And then once you decide what to order, it'll send you to Zomato, to that same specific place, whatever. It's a very simple product. Great idea.
Right.
And obviously it didn't work out for whatever reasons, right? It didn't work out. However, that same person is currently a chief of staff at Aether.
Wow.
Right. And his entire Aether interview was about his experience running Zood for Food.
Right? Yeah.
Once you've been a founder,
You can crack it.
You can crack any job.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. Once you've been a founder, you've been in that mindset. Right. Yeah. First of all, other founders will see that and hire you.
Yeah.
Number two, you just become this person who has relentless energy, who has this sense of not giving up. Right. This sense of, ye toh main kar hi lunga.
Yeah.
Right, you get there's a thing I want to, you know, I talk to my team about is the founder's ego. The founder's ego is actually very large.
Yeah.
Ki main kaise nahi kar paya?
Right. Yeah.
And so to satisfy his own ego, he'll make sure he cracks that, right? He gets that mindset of, first of all, a growth mindset, but also a problem-solving mindset.
Right.
Right. And that is very easily noticeable in an interview.
Mm.
So that's how we solve for placements. Ki make everyone a founder.
Yeah.
Make every student a founder. Placements will crack themselves. That's our very straightforward system here at Masters Union. Like, and I'm laying it out open for anyone to, you know, if you're looking for a job, start a company, you will get a job.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting, but I think that's still, I mean, I'd like to think that through this process, I understand why that makes sense in practicality, but through the process, is there a sense of uncertainty to whether or not you'll get placed because you're not following that traditional method? Because, I mean, what's the certainty, right? It's almost like I'm going on an experiment which might lead to a job, but I'm not sure. And since there's no definition for it before...
No, that's where data comes in. We have two cohorts that have graduated.
And now you can prove it.
And now we can prove it, right? Last year, we had amazing placements. This year, I mean.
Yeah.
Just a couple of weeks ago, we released our placement report.
Yeah, phenomenal.
And I can very honestly and through data tell you that almost 30 to 40% of all placements that happened because the students had founded a company, right?
Yeah.
And if I were to put my students into two categories, those who had seriously founded a company and those who hadn't, and if I had to compare their average CTCs, the difference of at least 30, 40% in favor of the ones who had started the company.
Yeah.
Right. And also in terms of the kind of roles you get, right? The people who had started companies, they're very easily able to crack chief of staff, founder's office, product management, these sort of roles.
Yeah.
It just comes to them naturally. Currently, and this is my favorite story. One of my students, he cracked a founder's office role at Zerodha.
Yeah.
Right. And Zerodha, Nitin Kamath, who's a founder, has publicly proclaimed on one of these podcasts that we do not hire from MBA colleges.
Yeah.
In fact, he's also said that they don't have any MBA in their team at Zerodha.
Yeah.
And they took an MBA as from their Masters founder's Union. Office.
Yes.
From Masters Union. And that was because Dipankar, who was a student, had actually started a company called, I'll just come to me. But what the company did was, it was a real money game on top of quizzing, right? So you win a quiz and you win money, right? And I feel like if enough students did that, if students did do that and now have data to prove, and so now with my third cohort, fourth cohort, I can very convincingly tell them, hey guys, just do this, this is the formula.
Yeah, and that's brilliant, I think. Yeah, that goes to show that there's method to the madness and then you can prove it with data as well, which is super cool. No, but I think I have been a huge fan of all that's happening here. And the other part about making it happen is the broader team, right? And it goes to the point that when you're trying to do something disruptive, it's very difficult to follow suitors who really believe in the mission or can actually believe in executing it rather, right? I think most people will say that this sounds intuitive, we'd love to do it, but the method is, I'm sure, very, very experimental in nature, for the lack of a better word. Talk to us about how you're going about building this team that goes behind, you know, doing some of these things, designing the programs, designing the activities, because this is a lot of unstructured learning built into one in a structure which can actually prove outcomes.
So I'll tell you what not to do, right? don't hire from other educational institutions.
That'd be my guess.
Yeah, that was the first thing, right? We did not recruit from other IIMs or other ISB or some, you know, colleges, right?
Yeah.
Because had we done that, then we would have become just like them.
Absolutely.
So we made it very clear that, you know, while we can hire their students, let's not hire people who currently work there, right? Unless you are unhappy about that system, right? In which case, you're more than welcome.
Yeah.
So we have stayed clear of recruiting from our competitors. We have tried to bring in people from other industries. We have tried to bring in people who sort of themselves never were big champions of the education system, right? And, you know, I love people who say, you know, my undergrad or my PG experience was just very shitty.
Yeah.
And I want to do something about it.
Mm.
So that would be the common theme that you'll find, you know, amongst the leadership team here. That's number one. Number two is that you have to go search for people. If you are only recruiting from the incoming leads, that's never going to build you an A-plus team. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. My most high impact hires have been people who I found on LinkedIn or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I went after them.
Yeah.
Right. And I convinced them to please leave whatever they were doing and join me.
Is there an interesting story there that you
can share? There are lots of interesting stories. So I'll tell you one. And you know, he's, you know, one of them, he is the highest impact team member that we have. He in fact came to us and he was leading sales at Naukri. He was leading one of the regions there. And he came to us to sell Naukri.com. And you know, when he was selling to us, he did a really good job. So I had told him that, hey, listen, you know, Naukri.com is not very good for recruiting professors and we need to recruit professors, right? And I just wanted to, you know, say
test
no.
It out.
Like, I just wanted to say no to him. And I said, you know, obviously Naukri.com is for corporates and not for universities, so just please go. So he left. The next day he comes back and he said, you know what? I did the entire search of the entire database of Naukri and I found these professors. You had said you will not be able to find professors. You know what? I found these professors. And that was incredible hustle.
Yeah.
And since then, since that time, I was after him. Join my team, join my team, join my team. There's another person who was trying to pitch something to us. And you know, we were just not able to give him time. Right. And he figured out that I was going to be taking a flight from Chandigarh. And I was in Jalandhar at the time. And he said, hey, listen, you're gonna be on this car ride. And in this car ride, there's very bad internet connectivity through that journey. So can I just come with you and we can talk on the way?
Wow.
How do you say no to that?
Yeah.
What can you say, right? It was bang in the afternoon. You can't say I have to sleep or whatever. I was like, sure, come, man.
Why not?
And he sold me the product in the car. And I wouldn't have bought it, actually, because the product wasn't very useful to me. But his hustle was so convincing.
Yeah.
I said, you cannot. You have to join me. Right. I have lots of other stories. There's one very high impact person we have in our team. She used to run a company before this, right? She had raised some $10, $15 million for a company and from like top VCs. However, she had to shut it down, you know, post-COVID things sort of changed, obviously, for the ed tech industry. She was in the ed tech industry. But she actually returned the money to the investors. No one ever does that.
Yeah.
No one ever does that. People like burn till they die, right? They realized very early on that, you know, their business model is not going to mature or sustain beyond a certain scale. So they went to the investors and returned the money. Just think about that integrity.
Yeah. It speaks volumes of the person.
Right. I read about this story on LinkedIn. We figured out who the founder was, messaged the founder on LinkedIn. And I knew that she'd be getting like, you know,
multiple offers.
So I said, let's close. Like, I think I sent her message on Friday. I met her on Saturday, closed on Sunday. Like, it had to be that quick because I knew otherwise she'd get
it'd be gone
somewhere else, right?
Love that.
So I think recruiting is something that founders should spend 30% of their time on.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's lovely. Goes to show, I mean, that you really have to be hungry to hire talent better than you, as they say, right? Like, there's often this adage that's used. It was very difficult to imagine that. I think those stories really prove it. To the first point that you were mentioning, very quickly double-clicking on it, right? I've seen a lot of founders just go ahead and disrupt industries that they don't come from.
Yeah.
Like, we were talking to Harsh of Pristine Care, no healthcare background, and building Pristine, right? The founder of Zomato does not have a food tech, restaurant tech background, whatnot, right? So we've seen these examples, and you went ahead and said something similar, right? Get outsiders. talk to us about what that really means. Like, I know the beginner's mindset and all of those fancy terms that you put it, but how does that actionably help you, even in teams, right? I've seen founders do that themselves, but in teams also is like very interesting to see.
Yeah. I think with founders, I think it's just about being innocent, right? Which you said, the beginner's mindset.
Yeah.
They think everything is possible.
Yeah.
But your question is more about the team.
Yeah.
I think, so I'll tell you a story. One of my team, very high impact person, he comes from this hardcore ed tech background, right? And he brings this systems mindset to a physical education institution, right? So he thinks in terms of scale, he thinks in terms of automation, because he's been trying to figure out systems for tens of thousands of students at his previous company, right? Here we only have, you know, a limited set of students, right? But he is always thinking of scale, right? He's always thinking of systems. He's always thinking of how can I reduce the amount of workload that each person is doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now he's bringing that mindset to our organization. And that to me is super useful because had it not been for him, I would have kept throwing people at problems.
Mm.
Because what we are running here is a services company.
Yes.
Right. And in services companies, you throw more people. Right? But he comes from a product background. Mm-hmm. And so he's trying to productize the entire college experience.
Yeah.
Right. He thinks in terms of playbooks, which I could not have done here because I come from this industry.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a very interesting example. Another one, which is placements. Mm-hmm. Right. So usually the way we do placements in any college is that you have day zero, day one, you know, all of that stuff, right? And, you know, in our very first year, we did do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay for us. It worked out.
It worked.
But when someone else started sort of heading placements for us other than me, she comes from a very different background, right? She comes from a sales background. So she started doing placements like she's selling each student to a company, right? So she packaged the student like a product, right? And that product had a very nice wrapper on it and a ribbon on top.
Yeah.
And that's how she's doing placements. Very different from how other business schools are doing placements.
Mm.
She literally wraps every student in a nice box.
Yeah.
Right. You know, puts some perfume on it, whatever. I don't know what she does, but she's able to completely transform our placements system.
Mm.
So what I think this diversity of perspective, experience in your team, they really are able to bring in experiences or systems that work in other industries to your industry. I think that's how innovation happens, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's shift gears again and maybe address the elephant in the room. And for me, that is the undergrad, right?
Yeah.
Now you're coming up with a four-year program for undergraduation at Masters Union. A couple of very quick thoughts there, right? And I'll tell you the outside perspective so that maybe we can get thoughts from you as to how you're designing it. But at the very onset, it feels like it's a four-year commitment, no degree. How will this run, right? Like, how do we go ahead and put our faith into it, right? As a consumer, I'm speaking. But at the same time, I also know that, you know, people my age are thinking experiential. They really want an experience beyond what the usual top colleges do, right? How do you bridge this gap of trust while maintaining the difference in quality that you want to serve and maybe marry the two in the best possible way?
So we realize that if you want to do undergrad, we cannot say no to degrees.
Okay. So there are degrees.
So there are degrees actually.
Okay.
So we work with Delhi University and each of our undergraduate students will actually get a Delhi University degree.
Awesome.
Right? And Delhi University was very forthcoming in helping us do this, right?
Brilliant.
This goes back to that familiarity concept.
Yeah.
Right? The undergrad market, you cannot tell them today, hey, listen, no degrees. Yeah. They will not accept it.
Right? Exactly.
So we are not doing it at least this year, or at least for the next 4 or 5 years, students will get degrees.
Awesome.
Later on, if our program does well, and if the students get selected in the industry, and if they're highly valued, then maybe I can say no to degrees.
Great.
Right? But this is not the time for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, you have to balance, right? You have to balance. So we realize that the word semester is something that still rings a lot of trust in people, right? Okay, it's a semester system.
Yeah.
A lot of people ask us, okay, is it annual or is it semester? Whatever. And in the beginning, we had thought of having quarters.
Mm. Right? Yeah.
And then my team very quickly realized that, hey, listen, if we do quarters, people will get scared. Oh, will there be exams every quarter? And, you know, will the stress on my child will be too much? So we decided to go back to semesters.
Right. Interesting.
So while you innovate, don't innovate too much. Right?
Goes back keep to that balance.
Keep that balance. So what, you know, what we wanted to do was, you know, try to do this 0 to 1, build a business kind of a thing, right? And we realized that not all students in undergrad might want to build a business. A lot of them might want to join a company.
Exactly.
Right? Might want to, you know, sit for an MBA later on, right?
Yeah.
So we had to sort of reorient ourselves, change the product a little bit from the PGP product, and make sure it suits the undergrad audience as well. So we had to make a lot of adjustments to the undergrad program to make it easy to digest for the overprotective parent today. And we'll see, sort of, we'll also learn. Maybe this does well, maybe it doesn't, right?
Yeah.
So the jury's still out on that.
Yeah. What are you most excited about when this program launches?
It's, you know, whenever you start a business, you always think about that, you know, this is the persona that I will attract. And you create your product, your marketing around that persona.
Yeah.
Right? We do that in product management, develop personas. Every founder has probably done this.
Yeah.
Right. In my experience, and even if founders don't sort of agree to this, or, you know, agree to this to public, more often than not, that persona that you actually end up attracting is very different. So very early on, I thought that, you know, Masters Union would not be able to attract the CAT audience, because that CAT audience wants IIMs, because that CAT audience wants structure, that CAT audience wants, you know, that safe job.
Reliability,
right?
Yeah.
But I was super surprised that in the very first year, almost 70% of all the applicants were CAT applicants. So I was proven completely wrong.
Yeah.
Someone in my team actually told me that, you know, that you should also target CAT audiences. And then, so every year I'm surprised by the kind of persona that comes in. So for undergrad, I'm super excited to see who are the kind of people who are able to become our early adopters.
Yeah.
Will it be the people who do, you know, really well in JEE?
Yeah, the IIT aspirants.
Would it be the Delhi University folks?
Yeah.
Would it be tier school. 2, tier 3 folks?
Tier 2.
Dune school folks? Yeah. Would it be international students? Yeah. Would it be kids who are over enthusiastic to start their companies? Would it be kids who live in Delhi? I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have a persona in mind, but I know for a fact I'll be wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting to know. Waiting to be surprised if I had to summarize.
Yeah, waiting to be surprised. And then the thing is, like, you know, when you're running a product company, you're selling a service, right? You don't really see your customers that much. You maybe talk to them over customer support.
Yeah.
In our case, the customer lives in our home.
Yeah. You're interacting with them day in, day out.
Over a year, over 4 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Such a strong feedback cycle.
Such a strong feedback cycle. And you see them grow.
Yeah.
In Masters Union, the biggest gratification that I have every day is when I see that the student has learned a lesson and has sort of grown from what the student looked like yesterday.
Yeah.
Right? I've seen people who come in at 6 lakhs of salary and they graduate at 33 lakhs of salary. I've seen people who are not able to speak a word coherently give speeches confidently. Yeah. I've seen people who had no idea of what TAM, SAM, SOM means.
Yeah.
Right? And then, like, 2 months later, they're quoting as if, like, you know, they were born with that knowledge.
Yeah.
I've seen people who had no idea about how to do a pitch. Right. People who actually, now they are taking classes for their next cohort, training them how to pitch, right? That gratification, seeing somebody immense. Grow is above any kind of gratification.
Yeah.
Right. And so in undergrad, I feel like we'll be able to make even more of an impact.
Yeah. Cycles longer, you'll be able to see massive growth.
Right. And if we can achieve that delta, see, the problem is that in IITs or in IIMs, you get a student who's a 9 on 10.
Yeah.
And you might make him a 9.2 on 10.
Yeah.
Right. I'm sorry, but IIT did nothing for that. That person would have become a 9.2, 9.5, irrespective of whether he came to IIT or not. I strongly believe that.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you take a student at 7 on 10 and make him a 9.5 on 10? Can you take a student 2 on 10 and make him a 9.5 on 10?
Yeah.
That is true gratification and that is true validation of your business. So Masters Union, we have been the underdog.
Yeah.
Right. So we have not always had, sort of, at least in our very first couple of years, the best of the best students.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We did not have the toppers early on because the toppers went to IIMs, right?
Yeah.
Today is a different story because, you know, we have been established, but back then it was the case. So we proved our pedagogy, we proved our education working with students who were mid to up tier rather than the topmost tier.
Yeah.
And then we were able to bring them at the level of the topmost tier. And that was the gratification. So in education, you know, you change people's lives.
Yeah. Right?
And I think like that's something I'm super excited for as we start undergrad.
I can only imagine because, I mean, as you said, the gratification just from the outside seems so immense. Looking at somebody growing over 12, 16 months.
Once what happened at the graduation ceremony this year,
mm-hmm.
a parent came up to me. I'm not kidding. She started crying to me.
Wow.
She wailed and wailed and she's like, you changed my son's life. You brought him back on track. You know, essentially like she was giving me, I mean, I was super uncomfortable about this. She was giving me God status almost.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, no, auntie, maine toh aisa kya hai? He worked hard. Yes. But I realized what like master's union meant to that parent.
Yeah, it can create.
No other product can create that.
Absolutely.
Maybe shadi.com can.
yeah, fair. No, but I think huge kudos to you and the team for doing this because I think as a young individual in the ecosystem, I also see the need for how education can truly transform lives. You don't have to necessarily wait for a life-changing experience or a life-changing job to do that to you if education already does, which is not what is happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you're doing is an immense service, and I genuinely mean that. But, you know, the problem statement in my head, and I asked you this a couple of, maybe a month or two back when I first visited, regarding scale, right? Mm-hmm. Because it almost feels like, the first time I visited campus, I'm like, wow, all the things that I see on Instagram are true. They're not just, you know, a gimmick. They're actually learning by doing. There's so much happening. I remember like there was a marketing hackathon happening the first time I came. Yeah. So it was like, everybody's doing something. You told me that people, we actually saw a room which we were visiting. You were showing me a tour and people were sleeping there at 4 o'clock because they were up there tight. But what I'm trying to highlight is how does this scale, right? Because as a, you know, somebody who's plugged into the startup ecosystem, hosts venture founders, it's like, this should go to everyone. As a founder, I think, how does this scale? Because, you know, value that's equals opinion, scale. Yeah. As an experienced, somebody who experienced this, I was wondering, why can this not reach to like 1,000 people, 10,000 people, right? This ought to.
Yeah.
But I remember your answer at the time, and I'd love to hear your thoughts now, was it does not.
Mm-hmm.
It should not. I'm not building it for a 10,000 people audience, right? But how do you look at this challenging statement, right? As an ambitious person yourself, I'm sure you're also thinking, can I scale this to from 250 to 2,500 people? Does that happen? If yes, how? If not, why not?
Yeah, perfect. So I maintain my answer. This does not scale.
Okay.
I do not intend to scale this.
All right.
My ambition is served by my ambition, in a sense, to become top 10 business school in the world.
Hmm.
Right. So my ambition is not to get to 10,000 students. My ambition is to get to top 10 in the world.
Hmm.
Right. And if I, with this alternative methodology, this alternative pedagogy, am able to get to top 10 in the world, then others will automatically start adopting my pedagogy. And that's how it will scale.
Brilliant.
So yeah. And this has happened before. 20 years ago, HBS came up with the case study method of pedagogy.
Yeah,
HBS did well, and today all universities, all business schools across the world use the case study method.
Yeah,
that's how the case study method scaled. So HBS doesn't have to scale. The case study method had to scale.
Yeah.
Similarly with us, Masters Union does not have to scale. Masters Union has to become the best in the world, right?
Mm.
And just yesterday we declared on Economic Times that in 5 years we will be top 10.
Yeah,
right, in the world, and top 10 right next to Harvard, Wharton, Yale, Stanford, Stern, Sloan, LBS, INSEAD, we should be 8th or 9th.
Yeah. Right?
That's our proclamation. That's my ambition. Right? Once that happens, believe me, every business school in the world would be adopting our hands-on pedagogy.
Yeah. That's lovely. I've not thought about it that way, but when you put it like that, I think it puts everything into perspective and starts making a lot of sense there. But this has been interesting. The other aspect that I was wondering when I was, you know, trying to understand that when you build an education institute, what can go wrong? And my answer to that was stakeholder management. And without putting into fuzzy terms, all I'm trying to say is that, you know, you have a student, you have recruiters, you have practitioners who are coming in as faculty. Yeah. Mm. Then you have your team. Mm. building it out, right? There are multiple stakeholders,
right? It's a people
business. Yes. So, and multiple stakeholders with different objectives, I'm guessing, right? The student is trying to optimize for placements, for instance. The recruiter is trying to optimize for great quality talent. The so on and so forth. I'm sure you get the point. What I'm trying to understand from you is, how do you maintain almost like a mental map of trying to appease everyone and trying to ensure everyone's getting enabled to achieve the objective that they set out to? Like, how do you fulfill their objectives? Like, what is it for a practitioner to come in, spend their time here? Like, what is the value that you define for them? Yeah. How do you make sure they are important enough as much as the student? Because I'm guessing that's an important piece of the pie, right? And all of this I'm referring to, again, going back to the point, because this has not been done. So you have no playbook to rely on, right? So it's not like you can point to somebody and be like, they've done it. This should be intuitive for you as well.
Yeah.
You're almost reinventing it, right? How do you ensure these multiple moving parts and align them into one?
I think there are two answers to this question. One is that the incentives are aligned, right? Even if yeah. the objectives are not, the incentives are, right?
Okay.
So everyone wants to build good talent. Student wants to do it for himself or herself.
Fair.
Teachers want to do it for the students. Hmm. Practitioners want to do it for the students. Recruiters want it for themselves, right? So in that sense, the incentives are fully aligned.
Okay. One single horizontal incentive, which is great talent.
Which is great talent, right? So okay. In that sense, the war cry is common. Right. You have your artillery, you have your air force, yeah. You have your everything, but the war cry is the same. Go win the war, right? Go build great talent. Now, in terms of specific stakeholder management, you correctly pointed out we have four or five stakeholders, sets of stakeholders. So for students, it's about high NPS in their class and high NPS for their placements.
Right? Okay.
For my teachers, it's about whether they're getting that gratification, right? Whether they're seeing the students grow. Right? Mm. And if the pedagogy is correct and the teacher genuinely is passionate about the subject and teaching, then that will happen. Mm. Practitioners also want gratification. It's super interesting. There is a human need to give back.
Yeah.
There is a human need to give back.
Yeah.
Let me tell you even more metaphysically how this works, or biologically how this works. Right?
Tell me.
So it's super interesting. And I might get some terms wrong here. When we are kids, right? When we are kids, our happiness comes from endorphins.
Hmm.
Okay, that's why you would see kids running around.
Yeah,
they run around. They're always sort of like
hyperactive.
That's because that releases endorphins and that causes them happiness.
Okay.
Okay. But what happens slowly is that your body becomes immune to endorphins.
Hmm.
Right, just as it becomes immune to anything, right? It becomes immune to endorphins. So you need a different kind of happiness, right? So then suddenly your happiness starts coming from dopamine.
Yeah.
Right? So that's when you want success in life. Yeah. That's when you want a hot girlfriend. Yeah. That's when you want a hug, right?
Yeah.
So it's super interesting that now you are getting happiness from dopamine. Mm-hmm. Eventually what starts happening is that your body becomes immune to dopamine also.
Yeah.
Right. And then for women specifically, their happiness starts coming from a different enzyme or a different hormone called oxytocin, which is released when you caress for a baby or when you care for a baby.
Yeah.
When you see a child grow up, that is when you get oxytocin.
Yeah.
Right. And so your happiness is dependent on your children.
Mm.
Correct. That happens, right?
Yeah.
But slowly, eventually, even that fades away. Mm. So you need happiness from something else. Right, and I'm forgetting what the name of the hormone is. We can probably write it below. I think it's serotonin. Not serotonin. One more.
Yeah.
That is released when you give back. When you give something to somebody, when you give alms to the poor, when you help somebody out. Right. That gives you this sense. That's why after 50, 55, people start doing philanthropy.
Yeah.
Because they get that happiness from it.
Wow.
So when we go to practitioners and ask them to come and teach, I mean, no one ever has said no to me. Even the busiest of people, like Bain BCG partners, they don't say no to me.
Hmm.
They said, of course we'll come and teach. Can we just do it on a Sunday?
Yeah.
Right. And we make that happen. So, that helps stakeholder management. This is slightly more convoluted answer to your question.
No, I love that. I think that's a very different perspective to how I've always imagined it. I've seen this in action. I think it's more relevant in the startup ecosystem, where it's almost insane and almost unbelievable how much people want to help or give back, right? It is incredible. And I think I agree to the point, but I didn't know the science behind it. So thanks for that.
It's actually very, everything can be boiled down to these four or five hormones. Yeah, the human behavior is about these four or five hormones.
Yeah.
But who are the other stakeholders, right? So parents are a very important stakeholder.
Yeah.
Right? Parents want their kids to be taken care of. They don't care if their kids make a lot of money. They just want to make sure their kids are happy.
Safety,
security, right? So you have to sort of cater to that. So we have a newsletter that goes out to parents, you know, just talking about, hey, listen, we don't talk about placements too much and all that stuff. Just talk about, hey, just...
Everything's fine,
happy,
safe.
Smiles, all of that, right?
Things are just safe, yeah. No, I think that's super cool. Do you have a mental model or clear objectives to address this? Or this is a low-hanging fruit where things happen by chance? Like, because I remember, so this comes from this, Brian Chesky talks about this a lot, right? Where Airbnb has clearly defined stakeholders, objectives for each of them, and almost metrics that align you to serve each of them perfectly well. Yeah. I've seen this become a low-hanging fruit in organizations because it feels intuitive, because it feels like it falls into place anyway. But when you do it with system, with the process, I think it exponentially increases the experience.
So for us, it's different. See, the mapping of customer journey and making sure there's a delight moment at every customer journey is what Brian Chesky talks about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's something you have to do when you're operating at scale.
Hmm.
Right? I have a 1:7 student to teacher ratio.
Yeah, which is massive in comparison to the world or India, right?
In fact, as it stands today,
yeah.
I have more people in my team than I have students, at least in my PGP program.
Right, yeah.
Right? It's super interesting.
Yeah.
So I have no reason to not give each student dedicated time.
Attention.
Dedicated attention. I don't want this to scale.
Hmm.
Teaching people effectively, I strongly believe, mentoring people effectively, I strongly believe, does not scale.
Right? Yeah.
So we should quit doing that.
Right? Yeah.
And so that's why we have established that we're not going to have more than 240 students in our MBA program and never more than 500 students in each year for our undergraduate program.
Yeah.
We're not going to happen. Not going to happen. And each student is mapped with a mentor. Each student is mapped with a teacher within the Masters Union campus. Each student is mapped with a placement mentor, and it's their job to give each student individual attention and cater to his or her needs, right?
Yeah.
We don't have to scale.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I think that again, everything starts to make sense when you put it like that, but I think from the outside, it seems like, okay, why are these parts, how do you figure these parts? I think as we, you know, come to a couple of, you know, concluding questions, I'd love to understand from you if you can maybe paint a picture for us in terms of, let's say, how does a student look when they enter the campus vis-a-vis what they're like when they exit? And you were talking about the gratification piece of it. And you, of course, published results for placements.
Yeah.
But let's put those numbers aside once, right? I just want to understand on a more human level what they look like. I mean, that exponential growth.
What is the delta?
Yes. I mean, what does that look like?
The delta, and we actually measure this, okay?
Oh, interesting.
Is in four ways, right? First delta is how they articulate, right?
Brilliant.
How they articulate, that's it. So if you ask someone a question before they start their Masters Union experience, they will probably answer in 300 words. Right. Mm-hmm. That same question, if you ask them after the Master's Union experience, they should be able to answer it in 30 words.
Brilliant. I love that you mentioned that. I think articulation goes, again, is one of those things that's so natural that people don't talk about it, but it's so crucial.
Right. Second is saying yes. Right. Okay.
Tell me more.
So, this is super interesting. You know, most of our students come with work experience, right? And a lot of the times, you know, we notice that if we present students with problems, they have this tendency of saying, oh, this is too problematic, let's move on.
Hmm.
They don't have a solutions mindset. They say no a lot.
Yeah.
Right? So if their boss were to come and say, hey, listen, you know, let's do this XYZ, they automatically look for reasons to say no. They look for reasons to...
Why is that? Is it more like a comfort mindset?
No, I think it's just that our education system at the primary, secondary, high school level has told people to always conform
conform, to believe and not question. I'm borrowing this from you itself.
Yeah. So because of that, people don't question. People don't question about how this could have been done differently anyway. So they say no a lot.
Yeah.
Right. What we try to figure out is that in this 1 year, we give them a diverse set of experiences that makes them say yes. That makes them look for solutions rather than excuses.
Yeah.
Right. And the way we measure this is super interesting. So, in an interview setting, so we do an entry interview and an exit interview.
Okay.
Right. In an entry interview, we always ask them this question, you know, what are some of the problems that you've been able to solve in life that you're super proud of?
Mm.
Right. And the answers are very, 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 very tired answers, right? Like they're
basic.
Not inspiring. They're
yeah,
not inspiring.
The basic.
Oh, you know, once like, my mom needed some help with something. And
Right.
They don't have answers, stories where they have solved problems.
Mm.
We do an exit interview where we ask them the same question, right? Yeah. What are some of the problems that you have solved? Now suddenly they have 5 or 6 problems that they talk about.
Right? Amazing.
As part of one of the experiences that they had in college.
Yeah.
Right. And that problem solving mindset, we see it grows while you're here. Right.
Yeah.
So first is articulation. Second is problem solving, right? Or saying yes. We call it saying yes in our internal matrix system. Third is hustle.
Mm.
Right. Which is the intensity with which you work.
Okay.
Okay. And this is something we test for when students come in. When they come in, we actually ask them to do a video as part of their application process.
All right.
But it's an optional video.
Hmm.
Right. Only 20% of the applicants actually do it.
Do it.
Right. Automatically for me, they are hustlers. They did something that was not required of them.
Yeah.
Right. So whoever's watching this, and if you're applying, do the video, right?
This is your secret
this
hack.
This is your secret, right? Now, number one. Number two, there are some people who would go above and beyond. We also give a sample video that, you know, this is what the video should look like.
Mm-hmm.
And again, out of those 20%, 18% people would basically just make a different version of that same video.
Mm. But 2%?
2% would, you know, completely outdo that video. Like they would do something even more crazier.
Yeah.
That to me is hustle, right?
Mm.
Now, through the program, they have a lot of submissions.
Mm.
They have a lot of businesses they have to start, right? And by the end of it, we do see this change happening where people start hustling a lot more.
Yeah.
Right? So if you were to give them an optional question at the end of the year,
yeah,
I promise you the people who answer it would be 50%.
Yeah.
Because they've understood that you have to go the extra mile.
You have to go out of your way.
Right.
Yeah.
So that hustle, that going the extra mile is something we measure, we really think about a lot. Right.
Yeah.
And finally, the fourth thing is collaboration. Right.
Mm.
Which is a factor of a few things, which is listening to somebody, you know, really understanding them, empathy, all of those things that we spoke about, right?
Yeah.
So by the virtue of being brought up in an Indian society, we are, even though in a family setup, very collectivist,
mm-hmm.
in a work setup, we are very individualistic. Mera kaam, mera target.
Yeah, the pronouns we use.
Wo hai, right?
Correct.
In the family, it's always about hum.
Yeah.
At work, it's always about me.
Me.
We'll often have people who are presenting ideas to us in a team, and then they would say, you know, my idea, my solution.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 other people standing on the stage, and they completely ignore that.
Yeah.
Right. What happens through the year at Masters Union is that all your assignments,
mm-hmm.
all your projects are done in groups, right? And they're hard assignments, and you have to depend on each other.
Yeah.
Right. Number one. Number two, we also try to design our projects in such a way that you have to depend on other people. Unless that person does his job or her job, you will not be able to start your job.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there is some sort of designing we do in that. So all of that creates this environment where people become better collaborators.
Yeah.
Right. So at the end of the year, we also try to check for, so the main thing that we do is we do peer scoring.
Interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
So every assignment will have maybe 80% score that is given by an outside authority.
External.
External. But 20% is always going to be peer grading.
Right? Awesome.
And what that does, it makes you be nice to people.
Yeah.
Right. It makes you...
You're incentivized to be nice. Yeah.
And then slowly it becomes habit.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine.
So these are the four or five things, softer things that we see people grow into, you know, in the 1 year that they're here. And we are very, very deliberate about these things.
Yeah.
We have not left this to chance.
Yeah.
Which most colleges have. So
exactly.
Learning is also a science.
Yeah.
Education is also a science. People just don't look at it that way.
Yeah.
Right? But we have these matrices and we try to sort of do it as much as possible. But I would tell you this, that we haven't achieved it like 10 on 10 yet. We are probably 6 on 10 in terms of the rigor of this particular matrix and assessment.
And always a work in progress. But I absolutely love that because I think that just goes to show the thought that gets put into designing an experience for an individual who comes into Masters Union and then having it evaluated on that basis as well. Not just like saying things that you don't mean, you know, things like walk the talk and stuff like that. I think that just proves it. And I think that's very, very helpful. I think, you know, as we conclude, I have like a series of similar questions that I ask most founders. And this is more on your personal side, right? One of the things that I often wonder is how do founders sort of go about the trajectory of absorbing, of, you know, initiating new conversations, of absorbing new knowledge, and then recreating as well? Because so much of what founders do is radically very different, right? And there are new challenges. And you have to be up to date, you have to absorb, you have to reflect, and then you have to act as well. Is there anything that you face a particular challenge with, or how do you think of this as a problem statement, right, in your personal life? Yeah. How do you upskill, for the lack of a, if I had to summarize, right? Because you are not just absorbing, you're also doing and you're reflecting as well. Yeah. What's your mantra?
I think for me, it's about talking to other founders.
Mm.
I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Tell us why.
I think like there is a founder mindset.
Hmm.
And founders only relate to other founders.
Yeah.
They're extroverted, so they will talk to everybody.
Yeah.
Right. They'll talk to everybody, they'll engage everybody.
Yeah. But that beer is
relate to founders, other founders, right? And so I've often tried to be part of as many founder groups as I can where people are vulnerable. Right? Founders will never be vulnerable in public.
Yeah.
Right. So for me, there is this concept called the forum, which is very cool actually. I don't know if you've heard of it. There's an organization in Delhi called YPO,
okay,
Young Presidents Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of YPO, which has around 100 members in Delhi, 150 members, you're also part of a forum. And a forum only has 10 members. And that forum is usually constituted of other founders. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that forum, you have complete non-disclosure, right? So that means you can share anything in that forum. It will never go out. You actually sign it with your blood.
Oh, wow. Right?
Number one. Number two, you commit to 100% vulnerability. Okay. Big. And you can do that because there is a non-disclosure.
Yeah.
Right. So I have been able to share my deepest, darkest desires, secrets, vulnerabilities in that group. And I have been able to get opinions on that. I've been able to understand what other people's experiences are in similar settings. Right.
Yeah.
If like I'm breaking up with my co-founder, let's say.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have one, but so that's why it's hypothetical.
Yeah.
I cannot talk about this to public. I cannot even talk about this to my mother because she probably will not understand right, what I'm going through. I can't talk to my spouse about it because, you know, she again might be coming from a very different background. Mm. I can only talk to other founders. So this forum brings in people very like-minded and gives them a very safe space to be open.
Yeah.
Right. So I really recommend, and by the way, my biggest source of growth is this forum.
Wow. Is this like a secret society or is it out there?
No, it's there. I mean, YPO.com. Yeah. Just please go there.
I had no idea. Yeah. But I think this is so required because I've heard this from so many founders on the show that we just relate to founders. We want to talk to peer folks, preferably folks who've been there, done that sort of a thing. So that we can get...
Also, none of those 10 people can be competitors.
Yeah. That too.
So they won't be so the same industry.
Yeah, exactly.
So in my one, there's no one from education.
Hmm.
So there's somebody from... there are two people from automobile, like two different automobile. Like one is a dealer and one is a you know, manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Another one who comes from HR background. Another one who comes from the services background. Another one who runs a hotel. Another one who runs, you know, a large tech company.
Yeah.
So it's so diverse. I mean, like, I'm so glad you asked this question.
Yeah.
And even if you can't join YPO,
mm-hmm.
try to build a group of 5 or 6 founders,
yeah,
and sort of make vulnerability mm-hmm. the central tenet of that group.
Yeah. I've also heard folks say that, you know, you need these peer founders or people that you're like looking, if not looking up to, you're just like learning from them on the fly and condensing time, right? Yeah, could be mentors, but do you have people that, you know, you surround yourself very consciously to, you know, actively upskill yourself?
I think it's a forum. I mean, it comes back to the forum. Thankfully, in my forum, everyone's much older than me.
Nice.
And because of that, they bring in experiences that are super cool, you know, super deep. And the forum gives them a safe space to share, right?
Got it.
That's the important part, right? Like, even if you have a mentor, even mm-hmm. if you have a group of founders who meet every weekend and drink together, let's say, or even if you're part of the same portfolio of, let's say, Sequoia or Accel or whatever, right? And you have these learning events where you go retreats and you learn from each other. You can have tactical learnings, right? You can have strategic learnings. But to grow as a founder,
you need to be vulnerable.
You need to be vulnerable. You need to first voice out your vulnerabilities.
Yeah,
I jammed up in this.
Yeah.
A founder cannot go on your story or, you know, on
on this podcast,
or
whatever,
on a podcast and admit to all the mistakes they have made.
Correct.
Right. They have stakeholders. I mean, I'll only say good things about and a few bad things that have no bearing anymore. If I'm struggling with something today, I'll never tell you.
No, that's really nice to hear. I think that's, I didn't know about that forum. So that's great for founders who are listening and also to know that, you know, how you absorb your energy. The other aspect, and, you know, I keep wondering about this about founders, is that you almost like the tribe, it pulls off different hats like it's nothing, right? And for you as well, I think you're wearing multiple hats as the founder of Masters Union. You'll also, of course, like, you know, have family. So you travel often from what I know. So you have to engage time there. At Masters Union, you're, you know, the director of all things that's happening, building a team, actively recruiting, posting content, whatnot, right? There's a wide ambit of things that you have to inevitably do. How do you embrace this challenge, almost thrive on it? And again, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a depth versus breadth problem, but is this ever, has this ever been an obstruction to your functioning? Or have you ever felt like I'm doing too much? How do you navigate this challenge?
I think the gratification takes care of most of the challenges, right? It's just so gratifying. The result is so good that you don't even think about it, right?
Fair.
That's one. But the other thing is that I think you need a supportive family. Like, you know, my parents understand that I'm busy with work. So, you know, they're very sensitive about calling me at certain times. And even if I don't show up at home one weekend, you know, they'll not make a big deal about it. They'll in fact support me. You know, my mom will send me food. All of those things really help you. So I think a supportive family is everything at the end of the day. I think nothing else more than that
substitutes
that. But I also maintain all my tasks in my WhatsApp to myself. So I have a WhatsApp group.
Everybody has that group. What's it called?
Internal.
All right. My one is called literally myself.
Okay.
That's a good one. Hope nobody's judging.
That's a good one. So there, all my, as soon as I write something down, it's not cluttering my head anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel like since I started doing that, it's been my superpower. Earlier, I used to do this on Evernote.
Yeah.
But Evernote is not as quick to register your thoughts on.
Yeah.
You have to open it, it loads, all of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen, right?
Barely
anyways
to
on WhatsApp, so you just do it, right? Now in that group, I'm gonna add my founder's office person.
And now it'll be with them.
The other thing is that I think everyone should have a founder's office.
And build it off entrepreneurs. Like, how do you build it out?
Could be entrepreneurs, could be people who work hard, could be people who can match your energy. That's about it. But you should have it because it really makes you 3x in terms of your effectiveness, efficacy. Since I have 2-3 people in my team and you know, like sometimes I can just tell them an idea and then they will make sure that gets executed with the relevant team. So for example, on Monday, I'm going for a wedding for 3 days, literally a day after. We're going to Goa for a wedding. And while I'm super excited for this wedding, because it's a close family member's wedding, I'm also thinking how the work will happen.
Super concerned. There's something on your mind always.
Exactly. So what I've done is I've just called my founders of his team and I've told them for the next 3 days, these are my priorities. Right? Just, can you just please take care of it, right? And they have that much say in the company
that
people take their word as my word. And they almost replace me if I'm not there for 5-6 days. I think so that's something that's super useful as well.
And that's interesting to know, because I've also realized that you're super approachable. Like, I mean, we are in one or two groups and, you know, we chat sometimes, and I almost receive a reply from you instantly, like in a couple of hours, if not earlier, right? And I think that's massively difficult to manage, but it's amazing how you pull it off. And it's great to know how you're, you know, just building out this entire piece and scaling yourself.
It's very interesting. Just to on that, I also have all of my 164 students on my WhatsApp. They can message me at any time.
Yeah.
And if they're listening to this, and I'm very happy to say it out loud, like, they will all get a response with me within 1 to 2 hours.
Yeah.
If they message before 2 a.m. at night, they will get it. They know that. Right. And that's also the case with all of my team members. I told them, like, every message comes is secondary to the student's message.
Yeah.
Like, they are the most important.
So students on priority one.
That's and that comes back to, like, this not scaling.
Yes. No. But I think it's interesting for, you know, I have two more questions, Pratham. What I would love to know before we close down is, we've spoken about scale for, you know, let's say the growth mindset for the students. We've spoken about how Masters Union as a model does not have to scale. The process has to. Talk to us about how your scaling journey has been, right? As an individual, and I mean more on the qualitative side. On the quantitative side, you know, you've done a bunch of things, of course, but beyond the, you know, tangible metrics, I'd love to know, what were things that you were absolutely unaware of that you now know with all your years of wisdom? Because, you know, you had, we started off with these notes, right? Like when we discussed learnings for you, but now with, you know, having built a SaaS company, now onto education, doing multiple things.
I think wisdom comes from reflection.
Hmm?
So a lot of people have a lot of experiences.
Yeah.
But you really have to pause and reflect to learn from your experiences.
Exactly.
I think sometimes you're in this grind of next target, next this, next that, that we forget to reflect.
Yeah.
And I've learned from my mistakes on this. I don't think I reflected for 6-7 years as I was building Outgrow. Right. And all the learnings that I was having were ephemeral. Like, they were learnings that I would have, sure, but never get to apply because they haven't assimilated in my fabric as an individual.
They're not part of your system.
They're not part of my system yet.
Hmm.
I might speak them out loud in a podcast.
Yeah.
But they're not part of my system yet.
Yeah.
So, and reflection is super important, where you take a break. You sometimes write it down or mentally take notes of what happened today.
Yeah.
Or last week or last year. And tell yourself, okay, what will I do differently?
So this is a deliberate part of your process now.
I'm trying to make it more so. It's not yet also as structured, but I'd like it to be more structured, where I say after 6 days or 1 week or two weeks or 2 months or whatever, I take some time off to just structure, to reflect, sorry. And so sometimes that happens, like on the go, like I'm in a flight and the phone is not working and then I'll reflect, right? It sometimes happens when I'm on a holiday, right? It sometimes happens, you know, so those, I think reflection is very underrated.
It's very key.
Is very underrated.
Yeah, underrated.
I think some people journal.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way to reflect.
Yeah.
Because you're forced to think about, you know, your learnings. But I think, like, maybe less than 0.01% people actually do it.
Yeah.
In any justified way. So, yeah. What about you?
I'm also, I mean, the single most learning for me also through the podcast has been the best founders are actually very, very self-aware. Mm. Self-awareness usually comes from a lot of reflection to action. Because otherwise, most things get attributed to luck or a lack of a process. But winning consistently is what founders do best. And in my opinion, that usually comes from a very safe space of being very inward focused and being self-aware. And that is a result of how well you can reflect, right? For me, I also wouldn't say, I think it's very uncomfortable because when you're a sense of flow, it almost feels like let's keep doing, right? Because it gives you a sense of gratification because there's an output.
Yeah.
But it's not sustainable because you don't, even if you're winning, you're not winning in a way that you can replicate, which almost defeats the purpose, right? Which is why I think it's amazing how you mentioned that. But I think being more thoughtful and deliberate about it is super crucial.
I mean, we do appraisals for all of our team members.
Mm-hmm.
But founders don't do their own appraisals.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't get feedback also, right? Like, we're not enough. like, how many times does somebody actively question you? Even in the most liberal teams, I feel that will always be lacking because you are coming from a point of view that's very different. And even if somebody has, they'll probably give you the benefit of the doubt because they don't have full context, right? So I feel it's very difficult. So I think the best founders on my show have mentioned this in a different way or form. Mm-hmm. You mentioned it in a different way. For me, I think I've also realized the importance of it. And the more I go through this, I try to be like long-term focused and I take pauses very often now. Mm. I mean, in the sense, just like stopping to not reflect in like in a journal way, but just think through my actions in a more deliberate manner. Like, why am I doing something to begin with, right? Is it just because I'm in a sense of flow that helps me be continue that and it feels good because I don't want to be uncomfortable? Because stopping is damn difficult, right? Especially when you're in a up cycle, right? Yeah. You're just riding the wave, you're doing so well.
You just don't have time.
Exactly. And I mean, it feels like a... It feels like a pause to growth, but I feel in the larger scheme of things, those like that one day in like 30 days is not a pause to growth. It's mostly like a...
It's a
huge benefit in the 30-year cycle.
Accelerator, in fact.
Yes. So I think, yeah, for me, it's more around just taking brief pauses and being okay with setting your own pace. But yes, I think this has been fantastic. As we conclude, right, and this is also something... which might come across as stereotypical, Pratham, but I'd love to hear your honest thoughts. You just spoke that, you know, it's very, the importance of vulnerability, you just accepted it out loud. To end, if you can maybe just share with us, not in a traditional way, but in the more proactive way, the challenges that you've probably faced, because very often, and I think it's a personal mission for me to not make this podcast make starting up sexy.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. Mm. It's not glamorous.
Yeah.
And because you're on that side, it feels very aspirational for somebody listening to me. Yeah. But I don't ever want that to be the message. So if you can maybe just end with challenges that you face and the core motivation that makes you do the abnormal, for the lack of a better word, things as a founder that you do, right? Like, founders will get up at like 5 o'clock, sleep at like 12 a.m. and like just like be full energy throughout the day, reply in 1-2 hours, whatnot. So challenges, core motivation to build Masters Union. That'd be a fitting end.
So let's start with the core motivation. That's an easy
one.
Let's
do it.
Which is, I think education is a problem worth solving.
Yeah.
And it is the problem, if solved, it solves 100 other problems.
Yeah.
Like poverty, like shortage of food, you know?
Yes.
It's sort of the mother of all problems.
Yeah.
So I think motivation there is just very, very clear, right? On the challenges front, and you know, let's try to be vulnerable on this, right? First is time for family, right? I recently watched this movie called Goodbye. I don't know if you've seen it.
I know. My sister was recommending
it. Yeah,
too.
You should watch it. And there, the kids, the mother passes away, right? And the kids are reflecting on how they did not spend enough time with her. And now they're just yearning for like one more minute. You know, if I could just be with her, right? If I could have just responded to her last call, if I could have just messaged her back. So one thing that I struggle with is, you know, like this thought of, am I spending enough time with my family? And will not spending enough time with them come back to bite me later in life?
Right? Yeah.
Most of the times when you ask people, what's your biggest regret? It's going to be, I did not spend enough time with my family, parents, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm on that path where it'll be similar for me. Right. And that to me is honestly like very scary.
Very scary.
Right. So I try as much as possible to take the last flight out or the first flight in to make sure I can spend some time with them. Mm-hmm. But still, it's not enough.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a constant struggle for me because the work demands me to be here.
Yeah.
My parents are in a different city.
Mm.
I take maybe 4-5 flights a week. Right. And still, it's not enough.
Mm.
Right. I watched that movie and I felt so guilty.
Right. Yeah.
So that's something that, you know, it really bothers me. You know, work will go up and down, but family is a constant, right? Like that. So you have to give it enough importance, and I'm not able to. That's one. Another vulnerability is that, just like this fear of failure, right? You have described me in so many good superlatives.
Yeah.
Now I have to live up to it.
Mm.
So there is this constant fear of what if I'm not able to? Right? Then I would like, you know, mereko aapne chadha diya upar, main girunga to bahut bura girunga type.
Yeah.
So that is something that does not let me sleep at night, that, you know, there's a lot of expectations riding on me from my team, from my students.
Yeah.
And if placements don't go well this year, if the campus is not ready on time, if I say something stupid on this podcast, what happens then?
Yeah. Have you failed before?
Yeah, all the time. Mm-hmm. All the time. And sometimes it's been all right because I've learned and I've sort of come out of it. Sometimes it's caused me to lose some of my team members, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sometimes it's caused me to have bad relationships with some of my senior team members.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes I've lost my cool.
Yeah.
Right? So, publicly very. Mm-hmm. Right? Sometimes I've taken super wrong decisions. Right?
Yeah.
And something very small that, like, you know, I forced my opinion on my team that, hey, listen, we need to have this yellow branding.
Yeah.
Right? And I told them, no, carpet also yellow. Now the carpet is fully stained.
Now I know who's responsible for this.
They kept telling me, no, don't do it. You know, like, let's go on the walls, maybe, but not on the carpet. Like, no, small failure. All the way to some larger ones as well, where I, you know, took certain calls to, you know, recruit certain students or recruit certain faculty that weren't very good fits.
Yeah.
And that created huge issues with our brand or whatever, right? So you fail a lot, but when, like, it's still, I mean, those smaller failures are still okay.
Yeah.
But the larger failure of, like, what if now I've proclaimed top 10 in the world, what if now it does not happen?
It does not happen,
My credibility is fully lost.
Yeah. I think there's some science to how a little amount of fear is actually good for performance. Yeah. And I think...
Productive anxiety.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it's called, so I'll probably refrain from that. But I think there was this very interesting... I'm forgetting the name of the person, but the Sequoia US, the global MD, right? He talks about this in his talk, that he's afraid he'll lose his job. This is at a Stanford talk, and he's mentioning this. Doug. Yeah, he's mentioning this. And it's the first time that I thought to myself, this is a very radically different thought, right? Where fear can actually be used as a motivator for action. And that's nice.
It's not, I don't think it's, I think it can make you do certain things that are not good, right? If fear is the main motivator.
Yeah, it can't be the primary one for sure.
It can't be the primary,
Yeah.
It could be a supporting one, but it should not overbear.
Absolutely.
Then you would try to cut corners.
Yeah. Because then you're making decisions out of fear, which never works.
Which is not good, yeah. So that's, but I see the value of it. I think there is a certain value, but it has to be balanced,
Yeah.
Super cool questions, man. This is, I haven't reflected in a while. I feel like this podcast was one large reflection. A lot of the answers I gave you, I don't think I knew about them. Like,
no, that's nice. I mean, my North Star metric as a podcast host is to ensure, can I make the guest on my other side think out loud?
Yeah.
And if they're thinking for the first time, I think I'd have done a good job.
Absolutely. It also comes out in the pace of your speech. So I realized today I'm speaking very, very slowly. This is because I'm thinking
you're thinking and speaking. Yeah. Much of hosting a podcast or being a part of it is actually just processing and expressing at meteoric speeds that most people don't really think out loud about.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's that. But no, this has been amazing. So we end with those two massive ones. I mean, I must commend the fact that you were completely candid there. I think both of those pointers are really food for thought for a choice of life that founders, you know, go ahead with, which is trade off with family time or just, like, you know, the fear of expectations, responsibility. For some, it's millions of consumers. For some, it's lack of spending time at home because they're at office. And the way you put it was really nice. Thank you so much, Pratham, for this conversation. I think this was massively valuable. I have certainly learned so much by virtue of just knowing more about how you do certain things, what the difference in education needs to be, and your process to it. So super thanks to you, and I hope you had a good time.
I did. Thanks for listening to
me. This was wonderful. Thank you so much, Pratham.